I am here with Kevin J. Anderson, a Hugo-nominated author of over 125 titles, editor, publisher, writing instructor. I'm sure I'm missing something there. So you are a prolific and very well-known author, but can you tell me something about yourself that our listeners may not know about?
Well, I grew up in a very small town in Wisconsin, which I like to compare the environment to sort of halfway between Norman Rockwell and Norman Bates. So I was this oddball kid, and I like to climb trees and tell ghost stories out in the woods. And I had a stash of comic books, and I built like Aurora monster model, like little plastic monster models of the Phantom of the Opera and the Mummy and everything. And my dad, who's sort of a normal all-American guy, was kind of frustrated because I wanted to read comic books instead of playing baseball catch, or I wanted to buy monster models instead of buying racing cars. And we had this really big fight when I was like 11 years old, because he gave me money to go to the hobby shop, and he wanted me to buy like model cars, and I wanted to buy a King Kong model. And so I spent the money on King Kong, and he kind of grounded me for a week because I was supposed to be like a normal kid instead. I'm glad I wasn't a normal kid.
As we all are. So by word count, your biggest original work to date is, I believe, The Saga of the Seven Sons, which is a seven-book series. But last year, you came back to that with Dark Between the Stars, which is up for Hugo this year. But can you tell us a little about just that whole universe?
Well, I grew up in science fiction, and The Saga of Seven Sons, that whole universe, that whole universe is like my love letter to science fiction. It's got alien empires and ruined planets and monsters and space battles and intrigue and politics and killer robots and like everything that I love from grand science fiction space opera. It's Star Wars and Dune and Star Trek and Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. So I did seven volumes, and I planned it as seven volumes to like sort of a war and peace in space, this whole thing with a million different characters and plot lines. And I finished that up. But while I was writing it all along, I was planning for another, like a sequel that would take place 20 years later with a new galactic threat that was coming in. I mean, you can't destroy the universe twice in one series, so I had to come back later. So I just love the color, the characters, the politics, the alien races. It's got everything that I enjoy about science fiction, and it's my longest thing, but also my most popular original work to date.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, your writing process is a little different from most in that you actually basically retreat into the mountains and dictate large portions of your books. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, I've always liked hiking. I live in Colorado, so I go out in the mountains and in the national forests, and I go hiking. And I don't have to choose between hiking or writing, because I'll take my recorder along with me, and I've plotted everything. I'm a very careful plotter, so I have my 130 chapters, and I know what's going to happen in detail. It's like drawing a blueprint before you build a house. So I have my blueprint, and I will go out with my notes for, say, three or four chapters. And I will hike. I can hike. I've done up to like 26 miles a day off in the mountains, and I'll be hiking and just dictate. And to me, my brain, as a writer, you think up the sentences and then you move your fingers to type them on a keyboard. Well, I think up the sentences and they just come out my mouth. I think my mom used to say that I would just say things before thinking about them, but this way I'm at least thinking about them, speaking them. And then I have somebody else transcribe it, and then I do the actual work at the keyboard, editing and polishing. So I do all different stages of it, but I find it more inspirational to be like out in nature and walking around. And it's also far from distractions, because if I'm sitting in the house, the phone always rings, or the doorbell rings, or the cat wants attention, or there's always something. But if I'm 10 miles away from the trailhead and I'm out of cell phone range, nobody gets hold of me.
All right, thanks. Now, you've written in several universes that were created by other people, including X-Files, Star Wars. You had a couple of DC Comics novels. How is that different from writing in your own universe?
Well, you have to get things approved. So there's a lot more like red tape and paperwork. So, I mean, I can't just say I'm going to write a Batman novel and write it and publish it. I have to go through like legal permissions and everything. So there's that entire aspect. And working for, say, Star Wars, there are approvals people, and they have to make sure that your book doesn't contradict somebody else's book that I haven't read yet because it isn't published yet. But as a fan of these, I mean, I'm not writing in anything that I'm not already a fan of. I'm already a Batman fan. I'm already a Star Wars fan. I'm already an X-Files fan. So it's kind of like exploring my inner fanboy of being able to write new Star Wars stories or new X-Files stories. And I don't see that it's any different. It's a creative part of the process that I know the universe of Star Trek, and so I could write a Star Trek story the same way that I might do research on Dallas and write a story set in Dallas. I mean, as a writer, you're supposed to be able to immerse yourself in an imaginary world, and it just happens to be my other imaginary worlds are Dune or Star Trek or something.
So with the return of X-Files and a new Star Wars movie coming up, is there anything in the works to write in either of those universes?
Not at the moment. I would love to. I mean, I really enjoyed my X-Files work, and I did 54 projects for Lucasfilm, so I had a blast with that. Although it's been quite a while, so it's going to be hard for me to jump back into it. But I would certainly be interested if they were interested. But if not, then I get to go see the movie and I get to watch the X-Files TV show just like a fan. And there's something cool with that too.
Yes, there is. So you mentioned Dune, which is I'm assuming our listeners will know that it's you and Frank Herbert's son Brian have taken over that universe and have written a. I don't even know how many novels in that universe.
14. I'm not positive. I think it's 14.
Is that substantial?
I could count if I had to, but off the top of my head, I think it's 14.
So is that substantially different from, say, writing in your own universe, like Saga of Sacred Sun or something?
Well, it is different because I have to study. If it's Saga of Seven Suns, I made it all up. I can write my own notes down. I know what the planets are, and I make up my own rules. For the Dune books, Frank Herbert made up all the rules, but he wrote like a 5,000-year history. His books, his six Dune novels take place over something like 5,000 years. And so studying all of that stuff, plus studying his notes and learning where he was going with it and understanding his characters in the way that he understood them, or at least make the attempt if I can, it is a different sort of process because you're borrowing somebody else's creation, and you also not only do you want to be accurate, but you have to be true to the spirit of it. I mean, you can't write a Dune novel that has nothing to do with the other Dune novels. You want the people who read the Dune novels to feel like that they're getting what they asked for, and that's one of the biggest challenges for me and Brian.
Okay, and Hunters and Sandworms of Dune, that was based off an outline?
Frank Herbert, he wrote, his last book was called Chapter House Dune, his last book in the Dune series. And that sort of ends on a cliffhanger, and then he passed away of pancreatic cancer. And we found the full outline of what he called Dune 7, which was this big, epic, grand finale that wraps everything up. But Frank Herbert, in some of his later books, he skipped over a whole lot of the action. He sort of like referenced things in a sentence or two that we would have dramatized in many chapters because there's a lot of stuff going on rather than, oh, by the way, the planet Dune was destroyed. Well, no, we want to actually show that. So Frank's outline that he was going to do in one book for Dune 7, Brian and I actually fleshed it out and dramatized a lot of the event. No, an outline is just an outline. It's just a breakdown of what the story is. And we wrote that into the two-volume grand finale, which is Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune.
Okay, and so Dune itself is a massive universe. You mentioned the books that Frank did spanned 5,000 years, and then you guys went back into the Legends trilogy, which was something like 10,000 years before. So the whole thing spans 15,000 years. Right now you are working on Navigators, which will complete a trilogy about the founding of the great schools. So what's next for Dune?
Okay, well, right. Just the day before we're doing this interview, I sent off Navigators of Dune to Brian Herbert. That was draft 5, so we might go through 8 or 9 drafts, just back and forth and back and forth, polishing it up. So this one is finally getting to the point where it's pretty close. It's getting fine-tuned. Right now, that wraps up the trilogy, and it's way back. We are exploring a lot of possibilities for more maybe film work or TV work. And that's kind of a huge challenge that Brian's been spending a great deal of time and effort on. And I don't have any big news to tell you. It's just it's a very long-term thing. With the end of this trilogy, I think we're going to catch our breath for a little bit. And because Brian's working on some solo novels, I'm finishing up this new Seven Sons trilogy. And I find that I have less time now to write than I used to because I'm running my publishing company and I'm also running the writing seminars and everything. But it's just everything that I want to do. It's all, I just wish I was cloned or something so I could do more of it.
So switching gears a little, your first novel, Resurrection Inc., was inspired by the Rush album, Grace and Depression. Since then, you've actively cultivated a relationship with that band. Recently, you published Clockwork Angels, and you have the upcoming Clockwork Lives, where you've actually worked with the drummer Neil Peart. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about?
So my first novel, Resurrection Inc., was it was a big science fiction murder mystery thing. And as I was writing it, Rush came out with a new album called Grace Under Pressure, and it seemed like every song on that album was relevant to my novel. There's like scenes from my novel were these songs because the songs of Rush songs tell stories usually. And I incorporated that on purpose. And when the book was published, I mentioned in the acknowledgments that it was all inspired by this album. And I mailed off copies of the book to the band and I got a letter back from Neil Peart, who's the drummer, but also the guy who wrote all the lyrics that inspired the book. And he had really enjoyed the novel. And that was, I think, 27 years ago, we struck up a correspondence and have a longstanding friendship on it. Recently, though, Rush was coming up, this was several years ago, was developing their own concept album for their new, it was a steampunk fantasy adventure called Clockwork Angels. And Neil was talking with me as they were writing the songs and coming up with the story, and I would brainstorm the story with him just because I'm a Rush fan. I thought it was very cool. And that developed into something complicated enough that he had asked me if I would write the novel itself, which I wrote it with him, and it was a wonderful experience, and I just loved that book. It's one of my favorite books I've done. And there was so much in there that we have spun off into a second book. It's not really a sequel. Clockwork Lives is more of a companion book. It's like a steampunk Canterbury Tales of a lot of the characters that you met in Clockwork Angels, but you don't have to read the other one to read this one. So we just loved playing in that universe, and I hope people will read Clockwork Lives.
Clockwork Angels hit the bestseller on Neil Peart's birthday. Is that right?
Yes. Well, it came out when it came out right before Neil's 60th birthday, and it hit the New York Times bestseller list right on his birthday. So I was able to text him to say he was a best-selling author for a birthday present.
But that was nice. So you mentioned your publishing company, which you founded Wordfire Press a few years ago. So what prompted that decision?
The whole publishing world itself is changing very dramatically. That when I got into the business, you knew that there were a dozen or so big publishers, and that was where you could send your books and they would publish it and they would promote it, and you, the author, would do some promotion, but your job was mainly to write the next book. And that has completely shifted around, because right now a writer's job is to write the book, but also to do nonstop promotion, to build up a social media presence, to do blogs, to do appearances and interviews and podcasts and all kinds of things. And the whole ebook revolution and print on demand, which means that you don't have to have a printer print up 10,000 copies of your book and store them in the garage as you try to sell them one at a time at a convention. You can just print exactly what you want. This is new technology that just simply wasn't available years ago. And it gives authors a whole different venue of being able to produce their own book and to get it out to their fan base. Now, I had an advantage in that I already had a big fan base. I've got 50 bestsellers and 120 books out. So we ourselves at Wordfire printed some of my own original books that that had gone out of print years and years ago. So they were just gathering dust, and we reissued them and found that we had a very large readership that was interested in them. And we did well enough with those that other authors started coming to us to get their books published. And they were Frank Herbert and his estate, and Alan Drury, the great political novelist who wrote Advise and Consent, Mike Resnick and Jody Lynn Nye, and just lots and lots of other authors kept coming to us. So we've now built into a fairly large publishing company with 270 titles, I think, out so far, and 50 authors. So that's a full-time job. and we teach writing workshops, and I'm still writing my other things. So not retiring anytime soon.
And we're glad to hear that. So WordFire follows a bit of a different model from most publishers. As I understand, you do most of your business at conventions. Is that right?
Well, not most of it. It's a whole different venue that we go to where the readers are. And there are lots and lots of genre conventions, media conventions, comic book conventions. It used to be there were only a couple of really big ones a year, but now they're just blossoming all over the place. Every large city seems to have its own comic convention or media convention. And when you have 50,000 people coming through the door who are all science fiction and fantasy fans, it seems to me that that's a good place to go if you're trying to sell science fiction and fantasy books. And we have a lot of our authors, and we treat them as celebrities the way that these conventions will have, like the guest star on a Star Trek episode is there signing autographs. Well, we have authors there, and sometimes we have really big name authors, but we also have very motivated newer authors that want the exposure. So we give them a spotlight, and it's a direct connection between us, the publisher, and the readers. Whereas in the traditional thing, there was the author would deal with the editor, who would deal with the publisher, who would deal with the sales rep, who would deal with the bookstore, who would then deal with the customer. So we're cutting out like 7 middlemen by just having face-to-face with the author and the person who's buying the book.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what you do with Writers of the Future?
Writers of the Future is a contest that's in its, I think, 32nd year now. And I've been a judge since about 1996, I think. It's open only to new writers, so it's not I can't enter it. But newer writers, it's a great possibility for them to get their stuff paid attention to. It's a quarterly contest, and it's writersofthefuture.com, so you can find it very easily. And I've been a judge for that, and my wife Rebecca Mesta is also one of the judges, and we read the stories a couple of times a year. They're rotating judges. And then once a year, all of the winners get to come to this big workshop in Hollywood for a week long with a whole bunch of best-selling writers and award-winning writers will teach the workshop. And we're there, and it's just this really great in-depth workshop that covers a lot of the stuff that I wish somebody had taught me when I was starting out.
So in addition to everything else you do, you mentioned the seminar. So several years ago, you, along with a number of other authors, put together the Superstars Writing Seminar, which in February will have its 7th iteration. I've gone to, I believe, 5 of them. So can you talk a little bit about that workshop and how that came about?
A bunch of best-selling authors were we're all friends. I mean, me and David Farland and Brandon Sanderson and Eric Flint and Tracy Hickman's been there a couple of times and Sherilyn Kenyon. And so when you're at a fairly high level, you have to exchange information with each other because you can't go and buy a Behavior for Best-Selling Authors guidebook from Writer's Digest. And we were sharing information, and I was learning so much from these other writers that we realized that we should maybe share some of this information. And it's not craft and skill stuff. It's not how to write a better character. It's how to understand your royalty statements and how to understand book distribution and publishing and contracts and intellectual property and copyright and all that stuff. So instead of doing a writing craft workshop, we come up with the seminar where we're dispensing our own professional career building information. And the first year it was in Pasadena, and it went pretty well, and we kept going, and we've now, I think, something like 280 people have been through the various Superstars seminars, and I don't think that there's anything like it. This is just a very business-oriented, career-building seminar for 3 days, and we've really developed not just a tight-knit team of instructors, but the attendees are probably the strongest support group of new writers that I've ever seen in my career.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So what are you working on right now?
Well, I just sent Navigators of Dune to Brian Herbert, so he's doing his polish on it now. I'm just starting my edit on Eternity's Mine, which is the last book in the trilogy for the Saga of Shadows. And Clockwork Lives is about to come out, so I'll be starting to promote a lot of that. I may be doing some more comics work and some more Dan Shamble zombie PI stories and and running the publishing house and seminars, and I I don't even know what I'm doing. And where you're hearing me cough here, it's because we're in Spokane and there's forest fires all over the place, so I can barely breathe in the air. But I keep busy, and I work on my laptop, I work on my recorder, I go hiking when I can. Yes, I'm very busy, but I wouldn't have it any other way, because I'm just really enjoying what I'm doing.
All right, thanks. Well, that is all I had for you. So just thank you for doing this interview. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gama. I hope you enjoyed it.